We're holding on page 98 in Sanhedrin, Ois Kuf Yud Aleph. Continuing on the topic we've been learning the last couple of days, the Gemara talks about the problems that are caused by drinking wine. We got into that by way of the Ben Sarur murder, where one of the things he does is he overindulges his wine, and that leads him to his downfall. So now the Gemara brings in this connection with Shlomo HaMelech. The last parak of Mishlei, the first few psukim of it, the Gemara is going to be quoting some of the first few psukim of it, and explaining that this refers to an event, to an incident in Shlomo's life. The pasuk starts off, Perek Lamed Aleph of Mishlei begins, Divrei Lemuel Melech, the words of Lemuel the king, Masa, the burden, meaning like a nevuah, Asher Yisratu Imai, that his mother, as we're going to see in the Gemara, whipped him, actually, and gave him Yisurim. So what's going on over here? Who is Lemuel Melech? Now, Sefer Mishlei was composed by Shlomo HaMelech. So how does Lemuel come in over here? So we're understanding that Lemuel is actually a nickname for Shlomo. So Amar Rav Yehuda, the Lemuel then would stand for Lemoy Kael. Lemoy is a word in Lashon Kodesh that means two. Normally in Lashon Kodesh you just have a lamed, the prefix lamed, or the word el means two, but you have sometimes as a poetic thing in Tanakh, sometimes it'll use the word lemoy. It actually brings, for example, you have an expression in Iyov, lemoy fi, to my mouth. Maybe in English it would be like to my very mouth. So therefore lemoy keil would be the one who is directed to Hashem. So his meisim and his chokhmah are supposed to be directed to Hashem. So Amar Rav Yechon, Meshum Rav Shimon Yechoi, Melamed Shekfa'ato Imo Ala Amud, this teaches us that Shlomo's mother, Bas Sheva, tied him to a pillar to give him malchus. So the background of it is like this. The Medrash tells us when Shlomo married, we know that Shlomo married many, many wives, far more than the Torah allowed him to, and his main one that he loved the most was Bas Parai. Which itself is an issur, because even aside from the number of wives, you have the Torah tells that a mitzri or a derimi ger or geyoris is not allowed to intermarry into Jewish people until three generations. There are mafarshim who find ways around it. For the Gemara says that it may not have been an actual marriage; it may have been more like a pilegesh. Some mafarshim say that maybe the parah of that time was not actually an ethnic Egyptian, and therefore there wouldn't be an issur. You also have, there is an opinion of Reb Shimon and a Mishnah there in Yevamos that says that the same way as by Mayovim and Ammonim, it applies only to men. The same way by Mitzvim and Adomim. The halacha is not like that, but one possibility is maybe Shlomo held that it was. Whatever the case, the Medrash tells us that she had. First of all, she brought in a 1,000-piece orchestra for their wedding. Only afterwards she tell him that the instruments had all previously been used for Avodah Zarah. She wanted to start having a subconscious effect on his mind to get him into that mentality. The next morning, then, continues the Medrash, it was supposed to be also the Chanukah Sabayis of the first Beis Hamikdash. Shlomo wanted to combine the two Simchas together, the Beis Hamikdash and his own Simcha. So she put a cover over the bed that she made to look like the sky with the stars and everything, with jewels in it, like the stars and everything. So Shlomo, every time he wakes up, he sees that and he looks like it's still the middle of the night, so he goes back to sleep. Meanwhile, he also has the keys to the Bais Hamikdash, says the Medrash, are under his pillow, because they're not going to open up the Bais Hamikdash to start the Avodah until they have Shlomo on hand, and he gives them official permission to open it and start. So now it's getting later and later in the morning, and what's going on over here? So they finally went to Bas Sheva. Shlomo, she's the only one who would have, who else is going to go, is going to go dare wake up the king, but she's his mother, so she goes in and she gives him this musr that we're going to say over here, and even gave him petch for it. In the end, by the way, there's in Brachas, it mentions that there was one time when they brought the Korban Tumid 4 hours into the morning, even though usually they bring it right around Alosa, between Alosa Shachar and Netz. This is why we have that the Sof Zman Tefillah is 4 hours in the morning. So the Medrash says this was the time. Shlomo slept in all the way there until 4 hours in the morning, and only then was Bas Sheva able to get him up and get the keys so they could start the Avodah. So now, so the Omrelois, she says to him in the words of the Pasuk, Ma Bri, what is it, what's going on, my son? O Ma Bar Bithni, and what is it with the son of my womb? O Me Bar Nedoroi, and what is with the son of my Nedorim? So what does all this mean? So why this triple expression? What is she expressing in that? Now, Maharsha points out the word bar, or bri, as in my, bar as in a son, or bri, my son, is Aramaic. The whole Sefer Mishlei, like most of Tanakh, is written in Lashon Kodesh. How does an Aramaic word, bar, fall in over here all of a sudden? So therefore, the Gemara is darshaning that it means not just bar as in son, but also the Meloshon Birur, Meloshon, the one who should be clean and perfect, and you're not living up to it. So she starts out by saying, when she says, ma bri, what is it, what's going on, what are you doing, my bri, my son, or my perfect one, hakol yodin shavricha yodin shamayim haya. Everybody knows that your father, David HaMelech, was a Yorei Shemayim. Achshav Yoimu, now when people see that you're behaving this way, and of course, I forgot to mention, what also was that Baspara got him drunk on wine, which is why this comes in over here, that now he got drunk and he slept in like that. So now she's telling him, everybody knows your father David was a Yorei Shemayim. Achshav, now when they see you indulging in wine and sleeping in until all hours of the day, Yoimru, they're going to say, Imoy Gormaloy, must be his mother caused it, because he can't possibly have inherited that kind of tendency from his father, the Tzaddik David. Ben Yehoyada points out a couple of things over here. First of all, I mean, David, throughout his life, had many enemies who looked down on him and claimed that he's a no-goodnik and all. But this was, and we're talking at the time, the Chanukah Beis HaMikdash, or the first Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that Ben Hashem made a public demonstration that David's Aveda with Bathsheba has been completely forgiven because the doors wouldn't open for anybody else, only when Shlomo mentioned the Schus of David HaMelech. So, Aseini Os Latova, David says, make me a sign for goodness. The Yerushalayim Evi Yevoshu, and Hashem tells him, as the Gemara tells us in Shabbos, yes, that'll happen after you pass away when Shlomo builds the first Beis Mikdash. So now, Bathsheba can say to him, look, at this point, nobody has any questions about David's Tzidkus anymore because Hashem made that public demonstration. So now, people are going to attribute the way you're acting to me. Also, by the way, Ben Yehoyada says the reason why, he says an interesting thing, why did she tie him to a post? Now, that is the posture in which a person is given malchus, but so what? She could have just whipped him in his bed or something. She says, because she's telling him, look, you're being mevatel the avoda in the Beis Mikdash, which is one of the three amudim, there's three amudim on which the world stands, and you're breaking one of them, so therefore you deserve to be tied to an amud. Anyway, so that's the ma'bri. So what are you doing? You might be, everybody knows your father was a Yorei Shemayim and your father never got drunk, and then they're going to say that I must have been. Maharsha points out, there's a Gemara in Nedarim that tells us there are 9 cases when a couple has relations and then conceives a child, where if there's one of 9 things wrong, the child is going to may end up to be a no goodnik, and one of them is Bnei Shikoda, where either one of them is Shikur. And then they have relations. And now she's telling him, look, everybody knows your father never did that. So people are going to think, how did you become like that? Must have been I was shikur at the time you were conceived. She continues. And what is it, son of my womb? What does that mean? She says, kol anoshim shal beis avicha, all the other wives of your father, all of David's other wives, kivin shemis abris, once they got pregnant, shulin and royis, pnei melech, they wouldn't come in to see the king, because they don't have an interest in it. They wanted to get pregnant, they wanted to have children, but they're not interested. That they're not interested in that afterward. The rest of the pregnancy, they're not interested. But I, says Bathsheba, I pushed my way in, and I would insist that David should have relations during the last part of the pregnancy as well, so that I should have a son who's quick and eager and robust, various possibilities of what mezuros means, but basically it means like healthy or meluban and fair skin. The Gemara tells us in Nida that during the last 3 months of the pregnancy, the couple having relations has that good effect on the baby. So she's saying, I wanted you to be the best you could be, the gashmius, so that you can use those powers for the best thing, beruchnius. You should have the clearest possible mind and the healthiest possible body. So this is all also bar. I wanted that things should be as pure as possible, the gashmius, the beruchnius, and look at how you're acting. So that's bar bitni. She's saying that even when I had a belly with you inside it, then I still made efforts that you should be as perfect as possible. And now what are you doing? Then she continues, and what is it, son of my Nedarim? She says, Kol Anoshim Shal Beis Avicha, all your father's other wives, are you nodris v'oimus? They would always make Nedarim. You often find, a person wants a child, or a person wants some other kind of bracha, they would make a neder to Hashem. We have at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, for example, Hannah promising that if she has a child, a nesativ l'Hashem, kol yimei chayav. Women would make a neder that they would bring a korban, or that they would do some other mitzvah, or whatever. So all the other ones would make nedarim promising that they'll do some mitzvah or some something for Hashem, but the oimris that they would say, what I'm davening for is Yehavi Ben Hogun L'malchus. I want to have a child who will be suitable for kingship. Now, granted, I mean, they know that obviously not necessarily is their son going to be the actual king, but at least they want to have that he should have the qualities of a body and mind and everything else that should make him suitable to be a kingly-like person. I just want to have a son who's strong and filled up with Torah and suitable for Nevuah. I don't care whether he has the qualities for a king. I mean, he should have those ruchniistic qualities. So that's a meban nedora. I made nedorim that, and I promised Hashem that I'll do certain things if he gives me a son with those qualities. And now what are you doing? Now what are you doing that you're going against all of that? So she continues a couple of psukim later. Allah malochim lemoyel. She says not to kings lemoyel. Now lemoyel on the face of it is the same as lemuel in the first pasuk, but the Gemara is going to explain that it actually has a different meaning. So there she goes. Allah malochim lemoyel. It's not for kings lemoyel. Allah malochim shesor yayin. It's not for kings to drink wine. So what does that mean? Allah malochim. When she says it's not for kings, she means omer lo. She says bni malacha itz malochim sheshoisim yain. What are you doing, behaving and then being like the other kings, the other goyish kings who drink wine, umishtakrim, and they get drunk va'umrim, and then they say when they're feeling very full of themselves, lama lanu kale. What do we need Hashem for? So now we're understanding. Lemuel, in the first pasuk we said, means lemoy kale, means you're supposed to be devoted to Hashem. But now we have lemoyel with a cholam, that means something else. It means, though it stands for lama lanu kale, why do we need Hashem? So these are people who deny Hashem when they're drunk and when they're feeling very, very comfortable and very full of themselves. So how could you be like that? Maharsha says, you know, it can also mean that right now you're being lemoyel. If you behave yourself, if you shape up, then you'll be lemuel like you're supposed to. So therefore it's kind of like a play on words like that. And she continues, although roiznim a sheikher, and for roiznim, which the simple meaning of roiznim means like nobleman or whatever, a sheikher, there should be no getting drunk. So what does that mean? What does roiznim mean? It means, misha kol roze olam gluyim loy, the one who, like you, all the secrets of the world are revealed to him. You're Shlomo HaMelech. You know all the language of all the animals, and you know all the great secrets of Torah and everything. Yishte yayin v'yishtaker. Somebody like you should be drinking wine and getting drunk. Ikadamni, or another version is, she tells him another meaning. I know another meaning of a roiznim a sheikher, misha kol roizne or the mashkimim lepischei, the one that all the rulers and all the noblemen of the world get up early to come learn, to come to his door to learn from him. Such a person should get drunk. So roizne olam then can mean the various kings and noblemen of the world, as we know, for example, with the example of Malchus Shiva comes to visit Shlomo. Maharsha points out, or it can also mean the Sanhedrin. We learned earlier in the Masechta that the Gemara had a pasuk that referred also to the Sanhedrin as the people who are involved in roze shel olam and the secret of the world, because they judge dini nefashos, which among other things, every person is an olam malei. So now they come every day to you to learn how to judge in dini nefashos, because you're a greater chacham than them, and so they're coming to you. And how you talk and then that you're going and getting drunk like that, and you're sleeping in until 4 hours in the day. So that this is all the muster speech that she gave him. Don't continue behaving like this. Be what you're supposed to be. How do we know that Shlomo ended up agreeing that after all his mother was right and he was acting wrongly? So he says in the previous perek. So now we have to go back to the previous perek of Mishlei Perek Lamed, where he says over there, ki var anoichi me'ish, I'm more foolish than ish. So Rashi says it's actually in that masa. It's actually in the previous perek. The Bas Sheva's speech to him is in Perek Lamed Aleph. This pasuk that the Gemara is quoting now is in Perek Lamed. But apparently the Gemara is understanding in Muktam Mocha Batorda. So this comes after the other. Anyway, kivara noichimeish, he says, I'm more foolish than man, vlevinas odam li, and I have no understanding of odam. So So what does he mean? Kivar anoshi me'ish means me noyach. I'm more foolish than noyach. Bichtiv, as we learned yesterday, vayochel noyach isha adama. Noyach is described when he planted his vine at his vineyard. He's called isha adama, the man of the earth. So I'm more foolish than him. Especially, he didn't know what the effect of wine is going to be. By him is the first time wine is ever mentioned anywhere in history, anywhere in Tanakh. In fact, the Medrash has a whole thing about it, that when he's first planting his vineyard and making the wine from it, the sultan comes and sort of helps him out with it and gives the wine its kick, such that the Medrash goes into details over there, like he shechts different kinds of animals over there and fertilizes the vine with their blood, and the result of it is that, like, after a person drinks one cup of wine, he feels like one kind of animal, and after another, like another, until he becomes like a monkey and then like a chazir, whatever. You have a whole thing over there. So, like, Noach couldn't have known better. I should have known better. And when he says, "V'loy vinas Adam li," and I have no understanding, I don't have the understanding of Adam, means that Adam Rishon, we're here, as we learned yesterday, one opinion is that Adam, that the Eitz Hadas was a grapevine, and Noach was nichshol in that, and here I didn't learn a lesson from that. Marsha says another way of looking at it is you can say, if we say, what about the other opinions, that the Eitz Hadas was some other kind of tree? Very well, then we'll say, well, Adam did completely without wine. I should have learned to be the same way, and I didn't. Ben Yehoyada mentions in this connection, on Kabbalah, it's brought that David and Bathsheba themselves are actually Gilgulim of Adam and Chava. So therefore, when she's telling him off before and saying people are going to think it comes from me, she's saying, in effect, you know, look, by the original Chetzei Tadas, it was Chava that got Adam into it. Now people are going to think that history is repeating itself. Mm-hmm. So now Shlomo ended up agreeing that she was Taka right in giving him that Musar and giving him those Tetch. Adam Rishon gave David 70 years.
This is
Shlomo we're talking about. Right after this, by the way, right after these few psukim, according to that, then Yehoyada brings from Sefer Kabbalah that Adam and Chava, when this is Galgal and David and Bathsheba. So therefore, so now she's saying, like, look, you know, history seems to be repeating itself, where Chava gave to Adam from the Geffen, and now people are going to think that I did the same thing, and that's why you became what you became. Right after these psukim at the beginning of Perek Lamed Aleph in Mishlei is these few psukim with Bathsheba's speech and of Musar to Shlomo. Right after that, the rest of the psukim of that Perek are Eshes Chayil, and there is in fact an explanation. And we know there's many different meanings of what Eshes Chayil represents, but one of them is that Shlomo wrote it in tribute to his mother, the Eshes Chayil, who put him on the right path.
You said this was the Hesped that Avram gave Sarah.
What? It's also the Hesped that Avram gave Sarah. It also refers to the Torah. It also refers to Shabbos. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different, as with anything in Torah, there's many different levels in it. But one explanation is the reason why it's placed right there in Mishlei is because it was also Shlomo's tribute to Bathsheba, that she was the Eshes Chayil who set him right. Further on, the Gemara talks about, so now we know, in order for a boy to be a ben sorer or murder, he has to have, the Mishnah establishes, that he has to have, after he steals the money, he has to use it to buy meat and wine and eat davka those. And the Mishnah mentions, and the Gemara explains, how we learn that it means davka meat and wine, is based on a pasuk from a different part of Mishlei that refers to zoilei vosser, people who indulge themselves in meat, and sove yayin, people who drink wine in excess. And since the ben sorer murder is described as zoilo the sove, so we learn from that it means meat and wine davka. So in that connection, the Gemara brings a pasuk that also refers to zoilo the sove. It says, "Ki zolo the sove yivorish," that a person who's indulgent like that and in food and drink is going to become poor. Okroyim talbish, and the pasuk continues, "Okroyim talbish numa," sleep is going to clothe a person in rags. Pashat pshat is, in other words, a person sleeps too much, then he's not going to work, he's not going to earn a living, and therefore he's only going to have rags to wear. So now the Gemara brings up drasha on that. Omer of Zera, hayoshen mebeis hamedrash, a person who sleeps in the beis hamedrash, torose nasas le kroyim kroyim. Then his Torah ends up being just shreds. Meaning Rashi says he forgets his learning, and what he remembers is only like bits and pieces. Shenemar, the same pasuk for kroyim talbish numa, that sleep enclothes a person in wags. So in other words, here the person sleeps. when he's not supposed to. He's supposed to be he's supposed to be learning constantly in the Beis Medrash, and instead he falls asleep. So the same way, so he ends up as Torah, ends up as patches and wags, like he knows a little here, a little there, but he doesn't really know it. He doesn't really know it thoroughly. Meaning, in other words, Ion Yaakov points out, you know, if you rip clothing, even if you sew it up, you can still always tell that there was a rip over there. This person, he may afterwards rehear what he learned before, but you're going to be able to tell that he doesn't remember it as well as if he had learned it with all the other Talmidim. H. Yosef also adds a point. It means, in other words, this person is going to be like he's going to get used to this kind of idea of learning Torah only occasionally, learning and then a break, learning and then a break, and then the result is this Torah is going to be patchy. So, well, you know, one point being, in other words, like this, while he's sleeping, everybody else is going ahead with the learning, and he's not listening, and therefore afterwards he's going to have a very patchy knowledge of it. But, well, there's an idea that there are many, many different places where it talks about various angles on this point, that a person's learning has to be as uninterrupted as possible. One example of that is, first of all, there's a verse they say when it says, Zos HaTorah Odom Ki Yomus V'Oyel, and the Gemara tells us that it means that a person, the Torah is Miskayim, only the Mishan Menes Atzmei Aleh, only a person who kills himself over it. I once saw somebody said, you know, it's like, if what happens, for example, if you get a phone call, well, you're going to want to take it. But what would happen after 120, you're not taking phone calls anymore. So therefore, for example, during learning Torah, consider as though you were after 120, as though you're already Mace Vahil, and don't be interrupting it with taking phone calls or other interruptions like that, is one example of that. It's brought also, for example, about Rabbi Akiva. You know, we know he's went 12 years away to learn Torah, and then he comes back and he overhears a neighbor talking with his wife Rachel and saying what a low life your husband is. He left you all these years with nothing, and she says, well, if I had my way, he would go back for another 12 years. And Rabbi Akiva right away turns around, and goes back to the Beis Medrash for another 12 years. So they have the question, you know, so what, he couldn't at least come in and say hello to Rachel? And there's an answer given, I think from Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, that says if he did, it would be 12 years and then another 12 years, which is not the same thing as 24 straight years. But then in order for him to become Rabbi Akiva, it had to be 24 straight years, and therefore he wouldn't even allow himself to just go in and say hello to her and his kids. Okay, turning now to Mishnayos, we're in the middle of Mishnah Ches of Peret Gimel. So we were talking about the front entrance of the Heichel, the Ulam. So the Mishnah says, "The Geffen shall zahav hoisa imedes al pischa shall Heichel." There was a golden grapevine standing in front of the entrance to the Heichel. Umudlar gabi klonsis, and it was trellised on poles. Like a real grapevine, sometimes you just leave the grapevine to spread all over the ground. The Mishnah in Menachos says that, for example, the wine for the Nesachim would come from such vines, but most of the time, or many times, what you do is you put up a trellis or a fence or something like that, and you train the grapevine to grow up along that, to hold on to that and grow upward. So here they had this golden vine in front of the Heichel was like that. Why a vine? For one thing, Jewish people are compared in a number of places to a vine. There's a whole in Gemara and Chulin that has a whole extended metaphor about it. The fruits are like the Tamid HaChamim, the tendrils by which it holds on to the trellis and climbs up are like the Balabatim, who supports the Tamid HaChamim, and so on and so forth, all the way to the leaves of the Amei Ha'aretz, and yet just like the leaves protect the fruit, the same way the Amei Ha'aretz are necessary for the Jewish people, even the Tamid HaChamim depend on them as well. So therefore, in token of that, they have this golden grapevine. If a person wanted to donate gold to the Beis Mikdash, I mean, they could just donate gold coins, and fine, there'd be a lishka for that. But if they wanted, he could donate a golden leaf, a gargir, or a golden grape, or eshkol, or even a whole golden cluster of grapes. Maybe the Torah boss, he would bring it, and he would and hang it on that grapevine to beautify the Beis Mikdash. And every so often they would clear off the gold, golden leaves and fruit and whatnot, and then the pastor just melt them down and use them for whatever the Beis Mikdash needed. Amar Rabbi Eliezer ben Tzadik, Mais v'Hoya, it once happened, so much gold was donated, v'nimnu ala shlosh meis koinim fanoisa, that they had to appoint 300 koinim to take off all the gold that was hanging on it. Now, the Gemara tells us in Cholin that was a guzma. They never let it that much. First of all, if there was that much gold on it, it would have broken under the weight. And second of all, they wouldn't leave it uncleared for that long. But the point is, in other words, people would donate an enormous amount of gold to the Beis Mikdash, and sometimes you had many, many koyanim who were needed to take it all off. Turning now to Perek Dalet, now we go to the Heichel itself. Till now we've gone through so far. We've gone through the Harabayis. We've gone through the Chel. We've gone through the Ezras Noshim. We've gone through the Ezras Yisrael and Ezras Kohenim. Why is this not working? Oh, there it is. Okay. So now we're up to the door of the Heichel. We've been through the Ulam, which is the entryway to the Heichel. Now we're at the Heichel itself. Pischa shel Heichel govay esrim amma v'roch v'eser. The door of the Heichel was 20 amas tall and 10 amas wide, which was the same size as most of the other doorways in the Beis Hamikdash. We said the doorway of the Ulam was twice the length and twice the width. They don't really have it proportional in this diagram, but the Heichel itself was 20 by 10 like most of them. Would you say them go? It's a good question. I mean, Papashtus not, because they're not supposed to go. Ben Ulam Blam is there. So Papashtus, when they say maybe the toilet bowl, it means you would give it to the Kohen, and the Kohen would hang it over there. Okay. So, the Arba Dlosis Hoyuloi, the Heichel had four doors, Stein Bifnim or Stein Bachutz, two towards the inside and two towards the outside. So here you have this little diagram that I put up over here. So you have two doors over here, towards the outside, and then two more over here towards the inside. Kenema, as Yechezkel describes in the third Beis Mikdash, Shtayim Dlosis LaHeichel VaLaKodesh. He says the Heichel and the Kodesh, the Heichel means strictly the Heichel in the broader sense means the whole building, but sometimes we use Heichel as a synonym for the Kodesh. So it had, there were two doors, and he says LaHeichel VaLaKodesh means two doors here and two doors here. The outer doors would swing into the door, into the thickness of the doorway. There was a 6 amma thick wall over here between the two sets of doorways, and the doors themselves were each 5 ammas wide, because two of them together make 10. So they were set 1 amma in, and then they would swing in to cover the wall next to them. Then the inner set of doors would, so those doors, the outer doors would swing 90 degrees and go flush against the wall. The inner doors would swing 180 degrees and they would go flush against the wall over here and over here. Which is why you have in the diagram over here, you have dotted lines in semicircles over here. Shekola bias tuach bezahav, because the entire inside of the Heichel was plated with gold, chutz me'achar dlosses, except for the area behind the doors, because during the daytime, the doors are going to be open, and anybody, any Kohen who goes into the Heichel is not going to see the wall behind those doors anyhow, because then the doors themselves are also plated with gold. That's the Tanakhama. Rabbi Yehuda says, as we have in the bottom part of the diagram over here, B'soicha Pesach Hoyoimdus. All of the doors, I agree, says Rabbi Yehuda, there were four doors, but all of them were in the thickness of the doorway. All of them were in the 6 amma thickness between the edge of the Ulam and the edge of the, and the edge of the Kodesh. Ukminis Shemita Hoyu, each one of them was like a folding door. So the Nikpolis Vachare, and so each one can fold in half and fold backwards to go against the wall. So Elu Shtei Amos and that, so the Elu Shtei Amos and that. So each panel of the door was 2.5 amos wide. Chatsi Amo Mezuzah Mikan, Chatsi Amo Mezuzah Mikan, and then you had a 0.5 amma and a doorpost on each side. So therefore, so that makes up the whole thickness, says Rabbi Yehuda. 5 amos for the thickness of the doors, plus 1 amma for the mezuzah, for the doorpost before you start to the doors. Shenemar, because he says that in the Pasuk in Yechezkel, it says Shtayim Dlosis Ladlosis, there were two doors for the doors, Shtayim Musabas Dlosis, two Musabas doors, which Rabbi Yehuda understands Musabas to mean hinged. Shtayim Ladelas Achas or Shtayim Dlosis Lacheres, two for one door and two for the other. So Rabbi Yehuda understands that Yechezkel is telling us for the third Beis Hamikdash, and it was similarly in the second, that each door was actually made up of two panels with a hinge between them. Whereas the Tanakhama would say that means there were two completely, it means just that there were two sets of doors, and each one had two doors in a set. In other words, you shouldn't think, for example, that there was one door 10 amas wide filling up the whole space. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, they all folded into the thickness over here, which means according to Rabbi Yehuda, the area behind the doors that according to the Tanakhama was not plated with gold, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it must have been, because otherwise you'd see it when you're in the Heichel. Okay. Mishnah Beis says, "Ushnei pishpishin hoyuloi l'shar hagadol." Now, this large gate of the Heichel had two pishpishin. A pishpish is a side door. We had it back in Perek Aleph in connection with Shar Nikanor. Sometimes you don't want to open the big door because it's very heavy. Again, it was 20 by 10 amas, so each one was five. Each one was 5 amas wide and 20 amas tall. They're quite large and heavy, but actually here the purpose of the pishbash was more, as we're going to see, in order to be able to go in and unlock the doors in the first place in the morning. The doors would lock from the inside, as we're going to see, so therefore you have to have a way of getting in. So there were two pishpishim, two side entrances for the Shar HaGadol, for the large gate. Echad b'tzofen ve'echad b'dorim, one on the north and one on the south. Shabadorim l'nichas adam b'olam. The one on the south, nobody actually ever went into it. The Olam of Furoshai, Yechezkel clarifies and explains on that. Shenema, he says he describes the Shechina coming to the Beis HaMikdash. So he's describing, again, in his vision, he's describing the third Beis HaMikdash. But as the Rambam says, they used some of the details of the third Beis HaMikdash when they built the second, and this was one of them. So he says, Vayomer Eli Hashem, Hashem says, Ashar Azeh Sogu Yiyah, this gate, meaning this Pishbosh, the side door, will remain closed. Lo yipaseach, it will not be opened. The ish lo yavoyvoy, no person is going to walk through it. Ki Hashem alakei Yisrael bovoy, because Hashem, the God of Israel, came through it. Lo yasogur, so it will remain permanently closed. So they had that over there. They had this one on the south end, permanently closed as a reminder of that. So for the third Beis HaMikdash, it will be that the Shekhinah actually comes to it. In the second Beis HaMikdash, maybe also there was a lesser level of the Shekhinah in the second Beis HaMikdash, but maybe the idea is also that they built it over there and kept it closed permanently as a reminder of how it's supposed to be. One explanation, the Tosfos Yom Tov says, why did they build the second Beis HaMikdash using some of the blueprint of the third? They couldn't use the whole blueprint because the blueprint of the third Beis HaMikdash that Yechezkel describes is meant only for a Beis HaMikdash that will never be destroyed. And they knew that the second Beis HaMikdash is not going to be like that. Nevertheless, they built it with some features of it to represent to themselves, to remind themselves of what could have been and what should have been. So this would have been one of those details. So therefore, you only have the northern Pishbosh to work with. So how would it go when the Kohen comes to open the doors in the morning? The Kohen would take the door, and he would open up the door to go into the Pishbosh. The Mishnah in Talmud gives more detail. The Mishnah in Talmud says, has the expression, Echad Yodid La Amas HaShechi, that he would reach in to Amas HaShechi. Rashi and Gemara in Bav Metzia explains what it means is that the point is, if you want to have the locks to the doors on the inside, then what good does it do then to have a lock for the Pishbosh on the outside? So what they actually had was they had a system where in order to get to it, you'd have to reach through a hole in the wall and sort of reach backwards. You'd have to do kind of like this. You'd have to be like reaching in through the hole with the key and open it blind. So the Mishnah calls that Echad Yodid. There are different other explanations among the Mefarshim what it means, but that's how Rashi explains it in Bav Metzia, that he had to open it in that indirect way. So you'd have to reach in through a hole over here in order to get to the lock and then fiddle around there to get the key into the lock. So then he pasachas a pishbush and he opens the pishbush. V'nichnas lahatah. From the Pishbosh, then he's going through the corridor over there into the Tah. We're going to learn about the Tahim further on in the Perek. These are all these cells, all these little rooms surrounding the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We'll talk about them later. So now he goes into the first Tah over here, or over here in the diagram over here, labeled Tah. So he goes into there, Omeat Tah LaHechel, and from the Tah he goes into the Hechel, and then he unlocks the doors from the inside. Rabbi Yehuda says he didn't have to go through that. He could go through the thickness of the wall. According to Rabbi Yehuda, there's a passageway here. According to Rabbi Yehuda, there's a direct passageway in. Remember, according to Rabbi Yehuda, the two sets of doors both fold in over here. Neither of them opens outward into here, like the Tanakhama says. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, there's an entryway, there's a passageway over here to go in between the two sets of doors. So he would walk and reach the point where he's between the two gates. Now, says Rabbi Yehuda, he could open the outer doors from the inside. The lock would be on the inside. Then he could open the inner doors from where he's standing, from the outside, because then there's no problem having a lock over there. Nobody can get in, because they'd first have to get in through the outer doors anyway. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, that's how he would do it. Mishnah continues, Mishnah Gimel, Ushloshim Ushmona Toyim Hoyushan. Now, there were 38 Toyim around the Heichal. These Toyim are little rooms. A Toyim means, and it can be translated as a cell, and in fact, in modern Hebrew, they use it to also mean cells as in biology. So there were 38 Toyim over here. What they were used for, we're not real sure. They may have been used to store treasures of the Bais Mikdash, among other things. We find, besides the Bais Mikdash had a treasury of its own, we find in various sources that people would also deposit money for safekeeping in the Bais Mikdash. In particular, it's mentioned in the books of Chashmonaim, which tell about the events in the years before the Nes Hanukkah, that in particular, often they would deposit money of Yesoimim in the Bais Mikdash for safekeeping, because they knew the treasurers of the Bais Mikdash are 100% trustworthy, and therefore they could rely on them that they'll keep it safely for the Yesoimim. So it could be Yisraelim couldn't go over here. So no, it would be the Gizborim, it would be the treasurers of the Bais Mikdash who would go in and out of here. Yeah. So one possibility is maybe they stored them in these toyim. It's also possible that we don't really know what they used them for. Anyway, Chamisha Asa Batsofen, there were 15 on the north, Chamisha Asa Batdorim, 15 on the south, Ushmoina Mamayrav, and 8 on the, and 8 on the west, behind the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In each row, Chamisha Agabe Chamisha Bachamisha Agabeim. In the north and the south, you have 5 toyim, you have three levels of them. You have a ground floor, then you have a second floor, and then you have a third floor. So 5, 5, and 5, there is your 15.
What was it, like a box or bigger?
What? So it would have been, so the way they're shown in this diagram and the way that most of you showing them understand them, they were long, skinny, there were long, skinny rooms, each of them 5 amas wide and between about 10 and 15 amas long. The Rambam actually has a whole unique shitta of it. According to the Rambam, the Rambam's understanding of it. What?
How tall is it?
How tall? So each one was 5 amas tall. So it comes out, in other words, the Heichal as a whole, we're going to learn later on, was 100 amas tall, but this area of the Toyim was much shorter. So if you looked at the Bais Mikdash from the front or from the side, you would see there's a main section which contains the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which is 100 amas tall, and surrounding it would be almost like an outbuilding, which is only 15 amas tall or so. So the Rambam has a whole different understanding of how these Toyim were arranged. The Rambam understands basically like you had a bunch of walls, one next to the other, like this. We have some walls over here. You have this over here, which is a stairway, and you have the Toyim over here. The Rambam understands that it's more like there was a wall, another wall, another wall, and each of the Toyim that Rambam learns was a very long, skinny room, so like 2 or 3 or 4 amas wide, and the full length of the Heichal, 90 amas long. Anyway, according to the Rambam also, as the Mishnah says, there were 3 levels of them. Rishabha Mayrim. In the west, it was laid out a little differently. Shloisha Agabe, Shloisha Shnayim Agabeim. In the west, behind the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you had 3 on the first floor, 3 on the second, and then only 2 on top of them. The Pashtus, those 2 were each wider than the ones below, so that they sort of filled up the whole space. So that makes 38 altogether. In the third Bais Mikdash, Yechezkel describes that it's going to be 33 instead. He describes you have 5 on each side, only 1 behind the Kodesh HaKadoshim, each one again of 3 levels. The Mishnah continues. Each of these Toyim had 3 doorways. Echad lata mayimin, 1 to go to the ta to the right side of it. Echad lata masmo, and 1 to the ta left of it. Echad lata shagabim, and 1 to the ta above it or below it, as the case may be. There was a spiral staircase to go from one level of the ta to the next ones. The ta that was in the northeastern corner, this one, that one had 5 entrances. Echad la ta min ayimin, 1 to the ta next to it over here. The echad la ta shal gabav, 1 to the ta above it. The echad la masiba, 1 to the staircase, which we're going to learn about later on. There was a staircase to be able to go to the second floor of the heichal and eventually even all the way up to the roof. So there was an entrance from that ta to go to there. The echad la pishvash, 1 to the side entrance that we learned about in Mishnah Aleph and Beis. The echad la heichal, and 1 into the heichal itself, whereas we said the kohen would go in there in the morning and use that to open the doors of the heichal. So that one had 5, and you can see 4 entrances over here, and then if we had a 3D view, we would also see the 5th entrance go into the next floor. According to Rabbi Yehuda, maybe it had 4, or maybe according to Rabbi Yehuda also, it had 5, maybe according to him. There is a way to get into the Heichal from there, but not that it would be necessary, according to him, because to open the gates you don't need, but yeah, the Mishnah doesn't say. And so the Mishnah continues.
allowed to go inside the Hefel except for Avodah.
They're allowed to go in there, right, only for the Avodah. They could also go in there to bow to Hashem if they wanted. They don't have to do, for an Avodah per se, just to bow to Hashem itself is considered a valid enough reason. Okay, so fine. We'll continue with Mishnah Daled tomorrow, Rez Hashem. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola, Days Menachem Av. Speaking of, so okay, let's talk about people going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So the Rebbe would often say in Sichus, would use the expression that we'll go to Yerushalayim and to the Harabayas and to the and to the Azorah and to the Kodesh, and even the Rebbe would say to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So people asked after a while, what do you mean going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim? Only Aaron goes in there, only on Yom Kippur, and only when he brings special korbanos. So first of all, there's an answer that Aaron HaKohen himself was actually, unlike later Kohenim Gadolim, there was an answer that some deists hold that he was allowed to go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim whenever he wanted. All the rules about having to bring Korbanos and only on Yom Kippur and so forth, there's an opinion that applied only to later Kohenim Gadolim. Well, very well. Osid Lover, then the Rebbe points out, all the Jewish people are going to be on the level of Kohen Gadolim, Atin Tilim, and Machas Kohenim, and be on the level of Aaron, so therefore that every person and every yid belongs in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, because if he can be in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Rebbe says, how could he imagine being anywhere else? How could you settle for second best, basically? Then the Rebbe points out in a continuation of that sicha that another point is, after all, they have to bring in the Aron and the Luchos, they have to get it from where it's hidden underground under the Beis Mikdash, and they have to bring it into its place in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the fact is any yid is allowed to go in there, the same way as we find. The Gemara tells us at the end of Erevin that people would go in there for repairs and things like that, and the Gemara talks about it, but even Tmeim would go in if necessary. If they can't find Rukmeh, they're supposed to use Koyanim, but if not, they can use Levium. They're supposed to use Tahurim. If they can't, then they can even use Tmeim, and they can even go in Derech Psachim, the Gemara says. If they can't, usually they would lower them down in the famous boxes from the ceiling, but if they couldn't, if there was something that needed to be repaired, they couldn't do that.
Something inside,
so that's the thing. So usually we understand that there were holes in the ceiling and they would lower down people in boxes so they're only seeing the part of the wall that they have to repair, but the Rebbe points out that after all, the halacha, as it talks about at the end of Erevin, is if they can't, if for whatever reason that can't be done, then these people, even Tmeim, even Yisraelim, whatever, are allowed to walk straight into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and do the repairs. So therefore, that's another answer of how the Rebbe can be saying in Sichus over and over that we'll all be in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Okay. Continuing with Hilchos Tefillin, you have a talus bag, you have a talus and tefillin in it. Make sure that you put the talus, as people always do, that you put the talus higher up than the tefillin. Don't do it the other way around, because you don't want to get to the tefillin before the talus. Then that would be called, you're supposed to put on the talus first, you're supposed to put on the tzitzis before the tefillin, and if you have the tefillin available to you first, then it would be maver ala mitzvah, so you would be bypassing a mitzvah in order to do that. Now, tzitzis is more tadir, because it applies on weekdays and on Shabbos and on Yom Tov. Tefillin is only on weekdays, and Todir, Vashena Todir, Todir Koidim, which is why you're supposed to put on the talus first, so make sure that you actually have them in that order, that you actually come to the talus first. What? You know, the trolls people don't do that. So actually, so that's what it goes on to say. If you don't, if you did put your tefillin above the talus, nevertheless, put on the talus before the tefillin. It's not considered in that case ma'avra ala mitzvahs, because the tefillin are still inside their bag. If the tefillin were to be sitting out there without a bag and without any covering above the talus, then you're right, ain't ma'avra ala mitzvahs, and then you would have to bless the bearer to put on the tefillin first before you put on the talus. But to avoid that, to have the talus available to you first.
Thank you.